So, hello everybody, a warm welcome to our first episode with Convivial Thinking Blog, and our first podcast episode as a part of this initiative. And we are extremely glad to have Professor Diana Fox, who happens to be the chair and the professor in the Department of Anthropology in the Bridgewater State University, US. And a warm welcome, Professor, to our first episode.
Thank you so much, and please call me Diana. I'm a very informal person. I've been following along with your work over the past, now it's been, almost a few years
that we've
been in contact with each other.
Yeah.
And it's really exciting to see your career developing and all of the wonderful, interesting, and important work that you're doing with people around the world.
Oh,
so it's
great.
Really a pleasure and an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much again. And today, so we will be talking about some aspects of social anthropology, ecological consciousness, gender and decoloniality, and how do they intersect with each other, or how to just diverge from each other. So I was wondering that, first, I would like to begin with a very general question, and what I have seen is that it is observed that the aspect of decolonial thinking and doing is not much touched upon in the field of anthropology, or to be more specific, in the field of social anthropology, as compared to other fields of academic and research engagements. So, as a researcher, what are the various ways through which you are trying to incorporate decolonial aspects of thinking and doing within your regular engagements in anthropological research?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let me start off by explaining a little bit about what anthropology as a discipline has been doing for the past now 30 years, I would say, with respect to decolonizing itself as a discipline. And I understand that this is not well known beyond the discipline, although that's really unfortunate because it means we're not doing a good enough job as public intellectuals outside of our discipline, communicating. Certainly in the universities around the world, students are learning what the discipline has been undergoing. So now let me share it a little bit with you and then tell you a little bit about how my own work is located within this. So starting in the 1980s, anthropology as a discipline in the United States and in Europe, prompted by the critiques that emerged from the former colonial countries, underwent what it called a self-reflexive moment. So with decolonization, or governmental decolonization, governmental post-coloniality, I should say, because culturally and in terms of economic power and other issues, we can say that we're in a neo-colonial period. But in terms of governmentality, as universities started to educate people in the Western disciplines that had been formerly colonial disciplines, as anthropology had, people started to read the ethnographies and the articles and the reports that anthropologists had written to describe and explain those societies. And they leveraged some very serious critiques. This began in the 60s and 70s. They didn't recognize themselves in many of the descriptions. So this prompted anthropologists who also in the West were experiencing social movements at home, civil rights, the American Indian movement, the women's movement, the anti-Vietnam War protests, etc., to take a look at themselves, to stand back and to start thinking about the epistemology, the methodology, the political and power dynamics of the discipline. And that self-reflexive moment led to some very significant transformations in the way in which anthropologists proceeded with their work. So bringing that down to a very, very concrete level, anthropologists had previously regarded those that they worked with as informants. The word informant carries with it not only a power dynamic, but a kind of a sort of degrading status as of someone who is willing to speak almost secretively about their society. You know, an informant is someone who goes behind somebody's back, right? And often, and that was the case, often anthropologists used various kinds of methods that were not above board to get people to talk about their very deep personal commitments. They sometimes went into sacred spaces, promising not to reveal esoteric knowledge, and then turned around and published that knowledge. And so there was a long history of colonial anthropology that was very unsavory. So anthropologists, not only unsavory, detrimental, harmful, and aiding in the colonial enterprise, acquiring knowledge to help colonial officials in their conquest and governing of the societies that were under study. And many of the first anthropologists were also themselves colonial officials. So examining the relationship between the anthropologists and the people that they wanted to understand underwent scrutiny in the self-reflexive moment that began in the late 70s and early 80s, starting to look at the relationships as potentially collaborative and as partnerships to bring about an understanding that was led by the questions framed by the people in their own society, rather than anthropologists entering into a society with a top-down approach, asserting what they were going to study and why it was important. So the whole process of investigating what is important and why was transformed. I have to say that this process is still underway. So now we have a significant number of anthropologists who are collaborative anthropologists, who are looking at their work as work that serves people in their own efforts. But we also, this is not so straightforward. It's not so straightforward because power dynamics exist not only in the anthropologist society, not only in the relationship between the anthropologist and those who are being studied, but within the society under study. And there are people who are experiencing oppression or marginalization within those societies as well. So when anthropologists are partnering with people in the societies that they want to conduct research and bring about various kinds of transformations, who are they partnering with? Are they partnering with people whose central goals are to sustain hierarchical relationships, many of which were further entrenched through colonialization, taking existing hierarchies and laying on top of them colonial dynamics? People who benefited from those relationships, are anthropologists partnering with those people, or are they partnering with those who are on the margins, who are in states of resistance, and for whom a partnership with an anthropologist would be beneficial because of the anthropologist's power relationship within his or her or their university? and can harness access to resources, access to funding, access to various institutions, such as human rights organizations, NGOs, to facilitate the kinds of community understandings, changes, improvements, whatever needs to be done on the part of the people who are marginalized. So a true decolonized anthropology will be one that seeks out partnerships with those who have been marginalized most through the combined process of existing hierarchies and those that have been doubly laid upon and further transformed and entrenched through the colonial process. Does that make sense?
Yes, I mean, that's amazing. In fact, I was just wondering with this aspect, and this is such a crucial question that you asked, that who they are partnering with. And I think the little bit of your works that I have read and I have seen, you know, especially when you were a Fulbright Fellow in the University of West Indies, I think while, you know, you closely worked with the Institute of Gender and Development Studies, and there's this Akila Jaramogi's Fondus Amandus Community Reforestation Project. And I felt that during this time, this particular question was one of the crucial questions also that you were very conscious of when you were developing this partnership, and you involved in the process in various forms of ecological community works as well. Can you elaborate on the various ecological community works that you were doing at that time, and how they were connected to the field of anthropology and gender studies?
Yes. So I've had four Fulbrights, and the first Fulbright was a year-long Fulbright where I spent half the year at the University of the West Indies in Jamaica, and where I started my fieldwork. I began my fieldwork in the Caribbean in 1991 when I was a graduate student, and it wasn't until 2004 when I went to Trinidad. So 2003 into 2004, I had a Fulbright scholarship where I spent half the year at the University of the West Indies in Jamaica and half the year at the University of West Indies in St. Augustine campus in Trinidad, part of Trinidad and Tobago, the two-island state. My work there led me to the Fons Amandus Community Reforestation Project. I was doing research with the Center for Gender and Development Studies, now it's called the Institute for Gender and Development Studies, which is a really exciting department in three of the University of West Indies campuses. So there's a department in Jamaica, in Trinidad, and in Barbados, the Cave Hill branch. And they all cooperate together. They're involved in regional gender policy. So they meet annually to talk about common problems in the English-speaking Caribbean, as well as problems that are specific to their own islands. And they map out the issues that need to be addressed. And so by the time I arrived there in 2002, the issue that I was centered on, the research project that I was focused on, was called Gender, Women, and Water. Now, the Caribbean islands are islands, but there are water crises. And this is in 2000, the early 2000s, and the water crises are at that time tied to climate change, but people aren't fully talking about that yet. But what is apparent is that there are changes happening, and the governments are mismanaging water distribution. There have been multiple protests over water policy in Trinidad, including the effort to privatize and bring in Canadian companies, for example, to manage the water. And so what the Institute for Gender and Development Studies asked me to do was to conduct a comparative ethnographic study across a number of communities around the island, and to try to understand the way in which gender roles were distributed in terms of water management in households and communities. Your screen is frozen, so I'm not sure that you're hearing me clearly over there. Is everything coming across?
Yes. It's
okay.
Fine.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so I went to do a number of studies interviewing people in many different communities around the island, trying to understand the way in which men and women used water differently. And in that process, I also attended a Caribbean Water Network meeting to see how those who were involved in making water policy were understanding the problems at the community level and whether those community problems were being figured into the water policy. I wanted to understand the relationship between the actual problems as they were described to me on the ground and whether those actual problems were understood by policymakers. And at that conference, I met Akilah Jaramogi and introduced myself to her. She is a very regal-looking woman. She's a Rastafarian who is wearing this gorgeous jewelry, and I am somebody who is interested in, I also teach the anthropology of art. I'm interested in indigenous art movements and how art is harnessed as a consciousness-raising tool. And I saw her as her being was a being of artwork. her body art was her persona, and I was fascinated and interested. And I introduced myself to her, and she told me that she was a co-founder of an agroforestry community and invited me to come to the community. That began a relationship that is ongoing for over 15 years now. And not only are we colleagues and friends, but we also have a kin relationship. Our families are close. Her daughters call me auntie. So we have definitely moved to beyond the realm of the anthropologist as informant, to the anthropologist as deeply embedded in kinship dynamics. And that is very significant in terms of the way in which knowledge is produced through relationships. And it also reveals the way in which ethics enters into publication and how you navigate the difficulties of personal relationships and professional relationships. But what I learned when I went to the Fonzaman's community reforestation project is that here was a community that was led by women that began as a reclamation, land reclamation project to take back land that was formerly plantation land. It was a pimento plantation that was abandoned by the state, and people were squatting on the land and depositing their garbage, burning their garbage, and the land was setting on fire, and there was brush. And this is in an area in Trinidad, in the foothills of the northern range, in the northern part of the island, where the rainfall that comes into the island is filtered and through this major mountain range and forests that is then distributed to the rest of the island. So when those forests are compromised, through burning, then this transforms the ecosystem and leads to what happens when there's deforestation, desertification, and the drying up of the water table, and all kinds of other problems that ensue from that. When you have no forest in the rainy season, you also have flooding. So there's a whole disruption of the eco-cycle. And Akila, who was at that time married, her late husband has since died, they squatted on the land as well, and they started to prevent the forest fires. They started to put out the forest fires and bring the community into their efforts. And then they started to bring seeds from the old growth forests that were still standing to this area and started to replant the forest. By the time I arrived in 2004, over 60,000 seedlings had been planted and the forest was regenerated and the water table reestablished. By that time, Akila's late husband, Takuma, had passed, and Akila and her daughters had taken the original community and turned it into a non-governmental organization. They had learned how to partner with other environmental groups, with women's groups, with black power groups who were trying to reclaim power in the aftermath of slavery and land dispossession. They were blending a series of social movements into an intersectional social movement that combined human liberation with cultural knowledge. This is indigenous knowledge that traveled with people across the Atlantic Ocean from Africa to the Americas that was retained and transferred into the farms that Akila's descendants had sustained in the southern part of Trinidad over a period of generations. Her ancestors are a group of people called Merikans. Merikans were slaves, former slaves in America. And they were given the opportunity in the War of 1812 to fight alongside the British for their freedom. And then the British would resettle them in another land that they had colonized. It's a very interesting and complex story. So many slaves escaped. These are called Maroons, people who were formerly enslaved and escaped to establish their freedom. They didn't have any loyalty to the United States at that time. Why would they? So they fought alongside with the British and then were repatriated to Trinidad, in southern Trinidad, in a series of what were called company villages, based on the company that they fought for in the British Army. And Akila's family came from one of those company villages. And this, the land of southern Trinidad that they were settled in at the time was did not have plantations. It was forest. There were the first peoples there. There were the Caribs. And the Caribs worked alongside, intermarried, taught, and also got knowledge from the African descendants themselves to rebuild communities. So we have this interesting blend of African and indigenous Caribbean peoples working together to create communities of cultural knowledge about sustaining the land. And so Akila took that knowledge to the foothills of the Northern Range, about a half an hour walk from Port of Spain, the capital. So you can walk outside the capital up into the hills and come to this ecological space. It's totally transformed. At leaving the city, all of a sudden you're in the forest. And it is within a half an hour walk. And you enter into a village, which is now also an NGO. And it is just an unbelievable place that was fascinating to me. And so I wanted to, not only did I want to understand the, its history and how it worked, and how the community was surviving, but I also wanted to help sustain it. It was something that I wanted to commit my time and resources to, as somebody who is the beneficiary of a Global North education in a prominent position in a healthy and well-off university, to use those resources to work toward sustaining a cultural and ecological space where Indigenous knowledge is crucial in maintaining that space and in harnessing the resources for survival and also for flourishing and building an economically green, viable community. So that's, I've committed much of my work to that project. I created a documentary, a short documentary called Earth, Water, Woman, Community and Sustainability in Trinidad and Tobago, that tells a little bit of this story. It was a documentary that had the community's objectives in mind first. That is, the goal of the documentary was that they would have a film that they could show in spaces, government spaces, meetings, community groups, educational spaces, all that is part of the operation of their NGO, that would tell their story and advocate for the kind of work that they're doing and be used as a model for other communities to learn how they could then do this themselves. To me, that is work that is using my privilege towards sustaining a community that is striving for equality and equity and well-being on multiple levels.
I mean,
and
that's,
it began with the Fulbright.
And that, I think that's fascinating, because the way you have just summarized, that is from how you began your project and how it turned into a community project. And while listening to you, I was just wondering that these various forms of, you know, scholar activisms, if I just put it in that manner, if you're engaged with. So how do you bring these aspects to the classrooms in the form of, for instance, curricular designs, then research, teaching your students, then pedagogical patterns? So in other words, I mean, what I mean is, usually the, as it appears, this transition from the social activism to the institutional academia, it appears to be very smooth and complementary, but sometimes it is not. I mean, it can be, I mean, just the opposite. It can be extremely challenging, and it might lead to various forms of impossibilities as well. So do you face any kind of challenge like this, or what is your experience?
I do face challenges, but first let me tell you what I've done in order to build the fluidity with this particular group. And also, just so that you're aware, this is one project. I have a number of, I work with a number of different communities. So this is a kind of model of one of the kinds of projects that I do. And it's kind of a microcosm or an example of how anthropology can embrace some of the self-reflexivity that happened in the 80s. That's when I was trained as an undergraduate, and then in the 90s, that's when I was in graduate school. So taking all of this and putting it into practice. So there are a number of levels and stages of bringing the relationships and the ideas that emerge and take place in the field, even that's a sort of a holdover of coloniality. but even though when I go there, I just digress for 1 second. When I go there, I'm welcomed home. I'm not really sure what to call it. It's kind of a second home in a sense, but how to bring those relationships and that other home space into my work life. The first thing that I decided that I wanted to do was to make my campus aware of the work that I was doing. So when the film was finished, I held a number of screenings. I went into a number of classes. I started to talk about what the possibilities were. And then I decided it had to go even deeper than that. And I worked with the community to establish the first interdisciplinary international field school, but that is the Bridgewater State University Fonds Amans Community Reforestation Field School. So it's been in operation for 5 years now, and every year a group of students go to Fonds Amans, live in the community, and develop research projects that are drawn from a list that the community develops, research that they want help achieving by students. And so the students spent up to 6 weeks, it depends when they go. They begin their research before they go. They continue when they're there and in a deeply immersive experience. They come back. They maintain communication through the way that we're communicating right now, through Skype or through their cell phones. Everyone immediately makes friends on WhatsApp and Facebook and Instagram. And so they start to use these social media tools to stay in touch with each other. Students have gone back on their own afterwards. They've sustained relationships. So this is building transnational feminist. It's feminist because it's liberatory, and its central goals are to unpack and reconfigure the hierarchies of patriarchy that have been so destructive, not only for human relationships, but for masculinities, for femininities, for our relationships with the land. So all of this work brings students into the community and also brings community members to Bridgewater. So people from Fonds Amans have come to Bridgewater. Akilah has come on numerous occasions. She signed an MOU with the university at the university. And so we have this ongoing. One of the challenges is funding. We have had to be really creative. Some of the challenges also have to do with student perceptions of the community, and they don't quite realize how rustic it is, that they don't quite realize what it means to live in the forest until they're in the forest. They rapidly go through a lot of challenges about personal hygiene. It becomes from a level of subjectivities. Who are we in relationship to our everyday life? These kinds of questions. And what is important? What kinds of resources must we have? What kinds of resources are luxuries? These kinds of questions. Where do those resources come from? How are they produced? All these kinds of questions start to be asked. And also to see Black women leading and making important decisions for many white students, although it's not exclusively white students, it's often students of Caribbean diaspora, of the African diaspora, Latin America, who have come on these trips. But it's especially challenging for white upper middle class students, and it's very healthy for them to be uncomfortable. That I tell them that you are going to be uncomfortable, and that's a good thing. So those are some of the ways that I've integrated into the university. One other example I want to share with you. I teach a folklore class, and early on in the semester, I often ask members of the community to Skype in, because they have grown trees that have seeds. I should have brought some to show you. I have some upstairs that have seeds that they make into jewelry. And Akilah has a line, an indigenous eco jewelry line called Akilah's Jewelry. And members of parliament come and buy her jewelry because the seeds have lore. They have folklore embedded in them. Some of them are seeds that are considered to be seeds of power, that focus the attention, that have healing oils that mix with the skin. They are woven. It's a material item that has stories behind it, and it's part of the forest that they have now recreated. So I've invited Akilah, who will be speaking to my students on Skype about the different seeds and how the trees are grown, and then she'll show them the seeds, and she'll show them ultimately the jewelry that's made. She'll show little pieces of wood that come from the carpenter shop down the road. Instead of having him discard the wood, he brings it up to her jewelry shop, and she adds it to the jewelry, so that it's a community shared resource that is transformed into an ecological product. So the students see that. So from the daily classroom experience to the field school and the partnership with the university, where they are an equal partner with the university, sharing the possibilities for transformational research with my colleagues, those are some of the ways that I've brought this research to my campus.
And I think it's fascinating, because as I was listening to you, you were just talking about how the white students just go around in the forest, and this experience of unsettling oneself consciously, because I mean, unsettling oneself unconsciously is a different experience, but unsettling because I know that I'm going to unsettle myself, and I know that I'm going there for one of the central purposes to unsettle myself. And I think that's a great experience. And I feel it's quite transformative in the process, that I get to, because usually what happens, we always keep on seeing that nature and the human civilization, the exchange from the part of the human civilization has always been very transactional. And it has been mostly at the cost of nature. But to be with nature, but to respect nature rules and regulations and work accordingly is, yes. I think it's always a great experience. And I wish I could continue further with the conversation, but very unfortunately, I have to stop here. And thank you once again, Diana, for this wonderful, you know, carving out this wonderful picture of your associations, of your collaborations, and also widely how anthropology can be experienced from the dimensions of decoloniality. Thank you once again.
Oh, you're welcome. Such a pleasure. We have to really appreciate Indigenous knowledge. And it doesn't just come with a degree. Knowledge is not just, you know, should not be valued only because there's a degree associated with it. There's a long history, and that's what I'm trying to do. I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit with you, Siam. Thank you so much.